Please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a trailer for the awesome podcast, True Crime Recaps, which recently released an episode on the 1974 abduction and murder of Carla Walker, the case that began Gone Cold. It's a good place to get familiar with Carla's case before diving into all 9 episodes of our coverage. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Contrary to what is often seen in popular culture, such as crime fiction novels, television shows, and Hollywood movies, murder convictions can and do happen in the absence of the victim's body. Whitey Bulger, who was, to put simply, a mafia hitman, for instance, reportedly liked and used often the phrase, "no body, no crime," when pridefully referring to his own terrible acts. A theme that pop culture likes to employ when portraying either the glorification of their bad guy or the struggles of their production's law enforcement hero. Hollywood is likely most guilty of representing the term corpus delicti, as Whitey Bulger does, no discovery of the remains of a victim, no murder committed. Though it was largely interpreted quite literally in the past, the current legal understanding of corpus delicti, which translates from Latin as the body of the offense, doesn't necessarily mean that, in the case of a homicide, a body must be found in order for someone to be convicted of a murder. The term refers to the burden of proof that the prosecutor must deliver, that a person was indeed killed and that the death was the result of a criminal act. In the case of homicide, the discovery of a body makes corpus delicti a little easier, of course, but even then, more evidence than the body, and say a confession, is necessary to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. In fact, a defendant's confession will likely be ruled inadmissible if forensic, circumstantial, and witness accounts don't tend to corroborate the confessor's claims. It can be extremely complicated to convict an accused perpetrator of murder without a body, to be sure, as confessions, accomplice accusations, witness accounts, and circumstantial and testimonial evidence must produce the perfect storm of proof. The body, in the term the body of the offense, then, needn't include an actual physical body, but instead a body of facts that prove that a crime has been committed. Perhaps the most notable Texas case of a conviction of murder with no body is the trial of serial killer Kenneth Allen McDuff for the murder of Colleen Reed. McDuff, on parole after being convicted of and having served 17 years for the deaths of 3 teenagers, one of which he raped, McDuff killed again, more than once. He was convicted of both murders, but in the case of Colleen Reed, a body was not found before the conviction took place. The conviction of McDuff heavily relied on the testimony of his accomplice in the crimes against Colleen, a man named Alva Hank Worley, which included aggravated kidnapping and multiple counts of sexual assaults by both men. The young woman was kidnapped as she washed her car at a do-it-yourself car wash in Austin, where authorities would later find the vehicle. Worley claims to have last seen Colleen alive, as she was placed in the trunk of McDuff's car shortly before he dropped him off at home. McDuff, according to Worley, dragged Colleen to the trunk, but not before hitting her so hard she hit the ground, Worley hearing a loud pop as the blow landed, which he presumed was her neck. She was mumbling just barely as McDuff closed the trunk but in moments, Worley said, the mumble stopped. McDuff asked him for his knife and told him he was, quote, going to use her up, and left. The descriptions of the depravity and torture in which Colleen Reed endured at the hands of McDuff and Worley go far beyond that. Kenneth Allen McDuff was the evilest of men, and Hank Worley his weak and willing accomplice. Worley told the court he never saw Colleen after being driven to his house. The testimony of McDuff's accomplice, of course, wouldn't be enough to convict him, particularly with no body. Witnesses, though, helped. Colleen's boyfriend spoke with her just prior to her disappearance, and she told him she was going to wash her car. Witnesses near the car wash, four of them, testified to hearing a woman screaming, followed by the sound of a car trunk or door slamming, followed by a car pulling out of the car wash, going the wrong way down a one-way street. Some witnesses saw two men in the vehicle, and one witness identified McDuff as the driver. These witness accounts corroborated the details of Hank Worley's testimony, as did the traces of blood found and hairs consistent with that of Colleen Reed found in McDuff's vehicle. Kenneth Allen McDuff was convicted for the December 29, 1991 murder of Colleen Reed and sentenced to death in February of 1993. No physical body was found, but the body of the offense, the jury decided, most certainly was. McDuff finally led authorities to where he buried Colleen in 1998, just before being executed. Closure is arguably non-existent. Cases in which the perpetrator evades justice, though, are excruciating for the loved ones of the victim. It can also be difficult, though, for the family and friends of victims for which the perpetrator is convicted and sentenced. But a body is never found. In 1987, two men were convicted of the 1986 kidnapping of Shelley Sykes, who, to this day, has not been seen since the night before her abduction. 19-year-old waitress Shelley Kathleen Sykes was expected to arrive at her boyfriend's home in Texas City shortly after her shift waiting tables at Gato's Beachfront Restaurant on Seawall Boulevard in Galveston, so sometime between 11 p.m. and midnight. When she didn't arrive, her boyfriend became worried and called her parents to see if she'd gone there instead, but she hadn't. Worried, her boyfriend grabbed his father and the two hopped in his car to see if they could locate Shelley. At 2 a.m., now Sunday, May 25th, 1986, they found her car. The blue 1980 Ford Pinto was abandoned, stuck in a foot of mud off the marshy northbound access road of Interstate 45, near the head of the causeway connecting Galveston Island to the Texas mainland at Texas City. The scene looked bad, and Shelley's boyfriend phoned police. It was immediately clear to Shelley's boyfriend and father that she hadn't simply gotten stuck and left the vehicle of her own free will. Police disagreed, apparently, at least at first. Even though the driver's side window had been shattered from the outside, the Ford Pinto littered with shards of glass and blood. They towed the vehicle within 2 hours of discovery, potentially ruining evidence of foul play. I realize they probably did everything by the book, Shelley's stepmother, Denise, later told the Galveston Daily News. It was noon the next day before they let us file a missing persons report. To us, the evidence was clear that she was taken, she added. She was right. Shelley Sykes was last seen leaving her place of employment to head to her boyfriend's Texas City home at approximately 11:45 p.m. Saturday, March 24th, just over 2 hours before her Ford Pinto was discovered. When the Galveston County Sheriff's Department began investigating, they considered what had happened at this scene to be a possible kidnapping, or worse, a homicide. Robbery was ruled out quickly, as the officers discovered Shelley's purse in plain sight in the Pinto, which held the cash tip earnings from her previous night's work, about $50. A change of clothes and a single shoe were also found inside. The keys remained in the Ford's ignition. Two sets of footprints were found outside the vehicle, one set shoed, the other bare. Detectives collected blood samples from the car to test whether they belonged to Shelley or the perpetrator, and they believed the latter, that the blood, they theorized, most likely belonged to the perpetrator, originating from wounds inflicted upon punching out the window. Police checked hospitals for someone seeking treatment for such wounds, asking them to keep a vigilant eye out for such an individual, as the medical facilities failed to produce any immediate leads. He took a gash, Galveston County Organized Crime Control Unit's Sergeant Tommy Henson told the Galveston Daily News. "He's got to be hurting," he added. Many fingerprints were obtained from the Ford Pinto. Ground and air searches were conducted. There was no sign of Shelley Sykes, whose best friend described as highly motivated, strong-willed, independent, carefree, caring, and understanding. A leader who, at her alma mater, Texas City High School, where she served as an officer on the drill team, the Stingerettes, was voted most spirited, most talented, and best personality. Just days after she vanished, Shelley's parents began a reward fund. The couple put up $5,000, to which their employer, Amoco Oil, matched. An anonymous Texas City resident put up another $1,000, and Crime Stoppers Texas also chipped in $1,000. The reward is not for information leading to prosecution, Shelley's mother, Erin, made clear. "The reward is for the return of my daughter in one piece. We don't care about prosecution. We just want her back," she also said. The $12,000 reward was being offered for Shelley's immediate release and return. Though leads and reported sightings of Shelley poured into the sheriff's department, nothing leading to her whereabouts surfaced. No developments. The sheriff's department pleaded with the public, through the press, for witnesses as to what happened to the young woman, and they began getting calls. One was from a man who says he'd seen a woman being forced from the mud-stuck Ford Pinto by a white male, who subsequently forced her into a pickup truck, which then drove off in such a way that caused the man to think that the driver was either inebriated or the young woman was relentlessly struggling. Other witnesses called in, too, and gave their accounts. Though they varied on the descriptions of the suspect's car, ranging from Ford Bronco or Blazer-type vehicle to pickup truck, the color from blue to white, four witnesses remembered the vehicle being there at that time since, they said, they had to apply their brakes as to avoid a collision with it. A description of the suspect was put together from the witness statements: 5 feet 9 inches to 6 feet 1 inch tall, 160 to 180 pounds, dark collar length, curly or stringy hair, unshaven with a well-tanned or olive complexion. And, of course, it was reiterated that the suspect likely has a bandaged arm or hands due to lacerations caused from breaking the driver's side window. A side profile composite sketch was made and released. However, the description of the suspect could describe any number of beachgoers or oil roughnecks in the area, and the sketch itself, quite frankly, left much to be desired. Nothing came of the sightings, and Shelley's parents continued to diligently look for their daughter, passing out thousands upon thousands of flyers with the help of Shelley's many friends and volunteers, and employing interstate billboards with pictures of the missing 19-year-old. Meanwhile, parents of teenaged girls and the teenagers themselves were living in fear. Several Texas City parents told the Galveston Daily News that they'd virtually put a complete halt to their children's mobility, not allowing them to take trips to the mall or drive after dark. Adults and young people alike began calling friends and family members before leaving and as arriving at any given location. Talk of carrying weapons in vehicles had become the norm. On Thursday, June 5th, 1986, the Coasters, the group known for Yakety Yak, Charlie Brown, and the incomparable song Poison Ivy, performed at a benefit show to help grow the reward fund offered for Shelley's safe return. An anonymous donor offered a reward of $38,000 if Shelley was returned safely by 6 a.m. that day. She was neither seen nor heard from by then, though, and the reward was withdrawn. Shelley's family responded to the event by increasing their portion of the donation, thus keeping the total fund at $50,000 until the following Thursday, June 13th, at 6 p.m. Though her stepmother, Denise Sykes, said, "We still feel Shelley is okay," she added, "At this point, we're telling this man that this is it. This is his chance to get any money. This is his last chance to come out of this." The Sykes family was through playing games and announced that the original $10,000 was, after June 13th, to be offered for the arrest of the abductor instead of Shelley's no questions asked safe return. The entire community came together in hopes of Shelley's safe return, organizing car washes and t-shirt sales to help fund search efforts and pad the reward fund. On Thursday, June 13th, just as the no questions asked reward was to expire, another incident shook Texas City to its core. Another woman disappeared, this time 28-year-old Donna Weiss. The mystery of Donna's disappearance would be partially uncovered 18 months later when her body was found, and after the eventual conviction of Timothy Lane Gribble for the rape and murder of another woman, when he confessed to the sexual assault and slaying of Donna Weiss and one other woman, though he would only ever be convicted and sentenced to death for one, 36-year-old Clear Lake Shores resident Elizabeth Jones. Regardless, the small town of Texas City losing two young women in such a short period of time devastated the town. On June 20th, the managing editor of the Galveston Daily News, Robert Fogley, issued a plea on their opinions page that residents begin to speak up and alert police of any suspicious activity, whether it is thought to be domestic in nature or not. Had a motorist intervened or immediately alerted authorities, the editorial said, Shelley Sykes may not have been abducted at all. Part of the blame, Fogley said, rests on our shoulders should we choose to ignore possible crimes. Just over a month since Shelley Sykes was last seen and her blue Ford Pinto found with obvious signs of foul play, over 300,000 flyers and posters had been distributed in 38 states. Shelley's father and stepmother, Eddie and Denise, along with her mother, Erin, refused to wait by the phone for dreaded or even welcomed news. The only way they could hold their lives together was by staying completely and utterly involved in the search for their missing daughter. "I don't think I could manage to keep myself together if I wasn't doing something to help find her," Erin said. "I just love my daughter too much to give up and sit here and do nothing." Eddie, Shelley's father added, I go to bed at night thinking about what I can do, and I wake up in the morning thinking about it. If she's alive or if she's dead, it still makes me feel like I'm doing everything I can. Shelley's mother, Erin, was almost unable to let her mind wander to the possibility of Shelley being gone at all and still maintain her life. They haven't found anything. They haven't found her body somewhere, she said, adding, maybe he's got her held somewhere. She may not be in too great of shape. She's going to need me in good shape so I can take care of her. Investigators continued to follow leads, but the case went cold all but immediately. New flyers made by the family begged for anyone leaving Galveston toward Texas City between 11:30 p.m. on May 24th and 1 a.m. on May 25th, 1986, to come forward even if they think they didn't see anything important. But nothing. The family's hopes lit up on Wednesday, November 12th, nearly 6 months since Shelley was last seen, when a Marshall, Texas convenience store clerk reported to police that a woman who resembled Shelley came into the store accompanied by a man who resembled the suspect's composite sketch. Though the lead was immediately acted upon by Harrison County authorities, the family's hopes crumbled, as the sighting produced nothing. The year turned with no sign of Shelley and no hint of who took her. Galveston sheriff's deputies performed over 1,000 interviews, had given 10 persons of interest polygraph tests, and checked a possible 2,450 owners of vehicles based on the partial license plate obtained at the scene of the abduction, with the help of hundreds of other jurisdictions. The FBI performed analysis and comparisons of 46 sets of fingerprints based on the ones found in Shelley's Pinto. But still, over a year after her abduction, there were no substantial developments. Authorities were no closer to finding out on their own what happened to Shelley, and her stepmother, Denise, began recognizing the poor condition of Texas's law enforcement and justice system. She became highly active in two organizations that lobby the Texas legislature for victims' rights protection laws. Specifically, these groups sought to require law enforcement's immediate investigative action when an apparent abduction is found or reported, require that the names of missing persons be immediately logged into the Texas Crime Information Center's database, and, after the mass parole of violent offenders in the mid and late 80s released back into the Texas wild, both organizations in which Denise was involved sought to make it more difficult for repeat and violent offenders to be paroled. Much of Shelley's family coped by becoming active and aware. It's been a really chaotic year of getting our hopes up and getting them bashed, Shelley's mother, Erin, said. It's been a painful year trying to make it, trying to keep busy so I don't think about her 24 hours a day. I certainly cling to the hope that she is still alive. There's nothing to indicate that she is not. That changed on Thursday, June 25th, 1987, 13 months to the day since Shelley's blue 1980 Ford Pinto was found trapped in the marshy shoulder of the Interstate 45 access road, when John Robert King's suicide attempt and the note that accompanied it caught the attention of the El Paso Police Department. King was drunk in his hotel room there the night he attempted to kill himself, and he chronicled the basics of the crime against Shelley Sykes in his would-be final letter. He'd recently moved to El Paso because the month before, the Sykes family erected two billboards with Shelley's photo, and King's conscience, according to him, had got the better of him. As they began investigating the letter, he confessed to police to his role in the abduction and murder of Shelley Sykes, telling authorities of an accomplice in her disappearance, a man named Gerald Peter Zwarst. In his confession, King told them that the two men began following Shelley Sykes in Galveston, driving beside her vehicle and harassing her on the Causeway Bridge. She flipped them off, he said, and he became angry and ran her off the road. When his attempts at breaking the window of Shelley's car with his fist failed, he kicked it, shattering it. It was found out at trial that several witnesses observed King dragging Shelley by the hair to his truck. One even stopped and asked King if he needed any assistance, to which he replied it was a family matter and that he should just stay out of it. None of the witnesses who saw the woman being dragged by the hair and heard her blood-curdling screams called the police until the story blew up in the press. King was arrested and agreed to wear a wire to let Zwarst implicate himself, which didn't work. Regardless, Zwarst was soon asked to come in and answer questions. He agreed and confessed to what he says was his role, which he claimed was to hold Shelley to the floorboard with his feet as the men drove to Spillway Park in San Leon, about 17 miles from the site of the abduction. King's parents lived close in Barcliff, and after they left the park, that's where they headed. King, according to Zwarst, quickly grabbing a shovel. The men then drove to the house King rented, where Zwarst said he saw Shelley in the bed of the pickup, and King stayed behind while he went inside. When he returned, Zwarst claims Shelley was nowhere to be seen. Several former jail inmates of Zwarst told the court that he'd told them he'd gone into King's house, fallen asleep for a time, and returned outside to observe King sexually assault Shelley with a beer bottle before bludgeoning her in the head with the shovel and ultimately burying her alive. Details of Shelley's fate, however, aren't fully known, because King and Zwarst have told accounts that not only contradict themselves, but also each other, both pointing the blame at one another for her slaying. The only certainty, it seems, is that the two men were extremely intoxicated, having drank booze all day at the beach, and both admitting to smoking joints laced with PCP. Neither King nor Zwarst could lead authorities to where Shelley Sykes' body was buried, supposedly in part due to their incredible inebriation. However, they often used the location of the burial in attempts at plea bargaining during their arrests and trials. Both men were convicted of aggravated kidnapping, and both received life sentences with a possibility of parole in 25 years. They were not convicted of murder. John Robert King died in prison in 2015 after being denied parole 3 years prior, and Gerald Peter Zwarst remains incarcerated after his parole in 2017 was, luckily, denied. It appears Zwarst has no intention of disclosing the location of Shelley's remains, presumably holding out hope for eventual parole. If Zwarst led them to the body, he could be easily tried for her murder, and the possibility of parole is much less likely. Though corpus delicti, the body of the offense, was proven to the jury beyond a reasonable doubt for both men in the abduction of Shelley Kathleen Sykes, prosecutors handling the case felt they could not provide the burden of proof in her murder. No body, no crime. Upon King and Zwarst's admissions, police in a nearby town took immediate interest in a detail that the men provided, one that matched a detail in the unsolved murder of a young woman in their jurisdiction 4 years earlier in 1983. That's next time on Gone Cold. If you have any information about Shelley Sykes' case, please contact the Galveston County Sheriff's Department at 409-766-2322. Don't forget to stick around to the end to hear a trailer for the podcast True Crime Recaps. The Galveston Daily News, the Victoria Advocate, the Austin American Statesman, the El Paso Times, the Odessa American, and court documents were used as sources for this episode. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. There are several varying donation levels to choose from, with perks to go along with each, including ad-free listening at all levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Okay, Amy, tell us what the podcast is about. True Crime Recaps Promo Take One.
It's a conversation about crime, just catching you up on what happened. Like if you're on the phone with a friend who swears a lot. It's like the Cliff Notes of murder.
Cut. Cliff Notes doesn't want any part of your murder conversation. True Crime Recaps Promo Take Two.
True Crime Recaps. It's the most fun you can have talking about murder.
No.
Episodes are less than 30 minutes. It's bite-sized chunks of true crime.
Gross.
I like my true crime the way I like real life. Fast and funny.
Say your name.
I'm your host, Amy Townsend.
Wrap it up.
True Crime Recaps, it's the fastest way to get your true crime fix, but, you know, upbeat.
New episodes released weekly. Subscribe to True Crime Recaps wherever you get your podcasts or visit truecrimerecaps.com.
Thank you.